Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. You may still use them, but the trend lines are clear. Physical banks are out. Smartphones for banking are in. And once that happens, anything can happen with banking. My guest today says money itself is being Uberized. Credit scores, the way you invest and save and borrow and lend, all of that is changing and will probably change a lot more soon. This hour on Point, the tech disruption hitting the way we bank and the Uberization of money. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the future of banking, of money? Are you already there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look at the low-income unbanked and underbanked in America and how they pay through the nose for simple services. But first, joining me now from New York is Zachary Carabel, head of global strategy at InvestNet, financial services firm for financial advisors and institutions. His Saturday essay for the Wall Street Journal is headlined, "The Uberization of Money." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Zachary Carabel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
What's happening here, sir?
So, if you'd asked someone about 5 years ago what were the least affected industries by this tectonic shifts of technology, you probably would have said healthcare and financial services. And in the past 5 years, partly because of legislation, just partly because of digitization of healthcare records, healthcare has really moved far forward in the technology disruption zone. Whereas financial services really are lagging behind. And part of what I'm speculating, based on a lot of activity, a lot of investment, a lot of startups, is that we are on the verge of that kind of disruptive change within the world of money and banking and investing that we've seen in retail and travel and almost every other industry, but we really haven't seen nearly as much in the financial world.
I mean, at the simple level of the financial world, I think I know a lot of people who perhaps can't even remember the last time they stood in front of a bank teller. Many people move well beyond that already and have the smartphone kind of already and their home computer maybe at the center of their banking life. What's happened already, Zachary?
Right. So you're entirely right that the kind of the point of transaction, the retail banking world where you and I deposit a check or
used to
have some sort of transaction, that has been digitized, whether it's by ATMs. I mean, that was a wave that began in the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. That was one of the first waves of change. But in many ways, that's simply a change in the way one transacts, right? It's not really a change in the fact that you still rely on this intermediary that is a bank.
I guess, though, it feels pretty different, people not setting foot in the bank, just sort of pointing their smartphone at a check and boom, boom, it's taken a photograph and the check is deposited. There's nothing even to do with an ATM.
Right. So that's way cool and it certainly simplifies our lives. But we're still paying an intermediary to conduct those transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're aware of how much we're paying or not, we are.
Mm-hmm.
They're either using our money, meaning if you put money in a bank, they're lending it out, or there's some transaction cost that's embedded somewhere in that check deposit. So while the way in which we do that may have shifted because of technology, the nuts and bolts of that industry have not changed nearly as dramatically as they have in a whole series of other ways. And
okay,
I think that's really what's about to shift.
So what is the new dynamic here that you call Uberization?
So look, it's an easy word to use because we're all familiar with it. It's kind of the word du jour. And what the idea is what Uber does is it either replaces a traditional middleman, you know, you call up a taxi dispatcher or a car dispatcher, or it becomes its own kind of very high-tech, low-touch middleman that is incredibly low-cost relative to the past. I mean, it's an algorithmic little middleman. It's not a human being, and so the costs are a lot less. So now take that, and what would that look like in this world of finance, right? Now you go to a bank to get a loan. You want to buy a house. You submit documents. Whether you submit them online or in person, you're still submitting them to an institution and they're assessing it, what if you were no longer as dependent on that middleman, the bank, for that financing? And that's just one way to think about Uberization, which is you connect people who need money with people who have money, or people who want loans with people who want to give loans, or people who want investments with people who want to invest, without the middleman occupying such a bottleneck and such a crucial role.
And all of those things are things you see coming on the horizon. Sort of walk through that. Let's say in this future, barreling down on us now, I want a mortgage. How do I get it without a bank sitting out there somewhere on the other side of the computer?
So in this respect, the future is already a little bit now, because part of what I point to and part of what we should all be aware of is there are now a lot of new companies, many of which have attracted hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars of venture capital investment, that are trying to provide these services in a different way. So getting a mortgage or getting a loan, again, one of the most traditional things you can imagine a bank does. There are now a whole world, and people in this world are highly aware of it, of peer-to-peer lending. Basically, you go online and whether it's something like the Lending Club or SoFi, this group called Social Finance, which is also starting to do mortgages. And by the way, I have no stake in any of these companies.
Okay,
I'm just talking about them because I find them interesting and compelling. And all of them may fail, as many startups do, but I think the trend is there. Let's say you, Tom, want to, instead of taking $1,000 and investing in stocks, you go, you know what, I think it'd be interesting to diversify and actually lend people money. Interesting concept. You might lend your friends money, or you might think it's a bad idea to, but you're not going to do it as a business thing. This whole world of peer-to-peer lending allows you to take $1,000, put it on one of these sites, have them diversify the amount of people or institutions that are receiving your $1,000, and you've essentially created via these new sites or these new businesses a risk pool, a pool of capital. It's you and 1,000 other people. So it's $1 million that could be lent out. And on the other side, someone who might have been rejected by a bank or doesn't even want to deal with a bank goes onto one of these sites and says, look, I need $35,000 to redo my garage, or I need $35,000 to start up a business. And you become eligible for a loan. You give them a certain amount of information. They assess your risk, not necessarily through traditional risk score metrics. And boom, you have this peer-to-peer lending world where you have essentially loaned money to a series of people who need money and no bank is involved.
So I might get a better return than I'd get on a bank deposit, certainly, which is nothing these days. Or I might go and get a mortgage right there. If I'm that on that side of it, I mean, SoFi, you mentioned, this is Social Finance, Inc. They're promising a potential borrower, I'm reading here, Forbes, to quote them, a rate on a loan within 2 minutes based on their response to questions asked on the website. I've got a little sound here, Zach Carabell, of Mike Cagney, CEO of SoFi, talking with CNBC in October. They do marketplace lending, student loan refinancing, mortgages, personal loans, non-bank alternative, and focuses on lower rates than traditional lenders. Here he is.
What we're trying to do in marketplace lending is not be the origination arm of a bank like many of our peers in the universe are, but we actually are trying to change banking entirely. We're trying to displace what we think is a fundamentally broken system.
And he went on to tell CNBC that he's looking with wealth management or banking, bank accounts. He wants to be a holistic solution, leading people to leave their existing banking relationship and just work with SoFi. Is that realistic, Zachary Carabell?
Well, first of all, SoFi has raised $1 billion in venture capital funding. Right? So somebody out there, and it's mostly Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley is certainly known for taking outsized risks on big ideas, many of which, you know, may be silly or may fail. So, you know, in that sense, it doesn't matter whether I think this is a good idea. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there are a number of people who do. And in a lot of sense, you know, there was a world before the banking system became the prima inter pares, the intermediary of intermediaries, where if you needed money, you either went to your local bank, which is a very different beast, right? It had to do with whether they knew you, or you just, you know, you tried to raise money, or you looked around. I mean, there used to be a more Wild West character to raising money, and a lot of our current rules and regulations stem from the fact that in that environment, it was both easier to get money and easier to lose money. So it is entirely possible that regulation frameworks, unless they prevent people from trying to put their capital in motion in a peer-to-peer sense, there's clearly both a huge demand for it. A lot of millennials and a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are suspicious of the banking system, don't like the fees, don't like the lack of control. And a lot of people think, hey, if I want to lend out my money as a way of investing, as a way of generating return, why shouldn't I be able to do that? And if I can do it online and diversify my risk through an app, I should be able to do that. So I think clearly there's a need and a demand.
Millennials with more confidence in an algorithm and an app than in a bank with tellers and offices lined up against windows.
Absolutely. And I think, look, there's an awareness that all these algorithms and all these apps are created by human beings for a purpose. Mm-hmm. So it's not really rise of the machines, right? We're not giving mm-hmm. away all this stuff to a random computer. It's a way of transacting that feels both more direct and also feels like you're more in control and is truly less costly. I mean, the reason why these things have a chance is because they offer the same needs and services, but they do so without the embedded infrastructure and costs of traditional financial institutions. If you're, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm not saying this is a negative thing, you've got to hire thousands of people to just do compliance for regulations, and you've got to have office space, and you know all the things mm-hmm. that make them not as able to be nimble, not as able to take risks, and very costly. Right? You can't give out $1,000 loan if you're a major multinational bank.
No time for that. Peanuts.
And it would cost you more to do the due diligence and give it out. So, you know, that's why these things have a chance, because they're low cost, they're frictionless. 2 minutes, right? Not 2 weeks, not four loan officers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about how more technology is about to change banking big time, saving, borrowing, lending, investing, everything, really. It's being called the Uberization of banking, of money, by my guest Zachary Carabel, his essay, The Uberization of Money, you can link to at our website, onpointradio.org. He's head of global strategy at InvestNet, Zach, and joins us today from New York, looking at the big changes that have already come and more to come in banking, ripe for disruption, he says. Here's a little bit from, this is a firm called Betterment. One of these companies online offers investing services for a fraction of ordinary fees, all online. Here's an ad featuring a guy hiking in the forest, a dad watching his kids play, a woman weeding her garden.
This is life with Betterment. Technology so smart, it automatically manages your investments for you. With the largest automated investing service in America, you tell us where you want to go, and we create a unique financial plan to help you get there. This is your future with Betterment. Investing made better.
Automated investing, and off it goes. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Will old-time banks just go away? Are you living entirely in this world already? Are you in a startup right now that's out to change the world of banking? Tell us about it. And what's the deepest you've gone into the Uberization of money? What about the people banking is leaving behind right now? We'll talk with Marissa Baradaran in a few minutes. She's author of How the Other Half Banks, the Unbanked and the Underbanked. But a lot of people plunging forward. Tyler in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Hi, Tyler. You're on the air with Zachary Carabel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
I'm just calling to say that I'm a young millennial. 26 years old.
Yeah.
And my boss, who's actually a year younger than me, has turned me on to many new forms of banking, like Simple and an app called Digit, which is actually an algorithmic app that kind of carves money off that you won't miss, almost like the equivalent of buying like a Starbucks latte, and stores it away in its own separate account for savings later.
And suddenly you've got an online savings account that has something or nothing to do with a bank, Tyler.
Well, Simple is an account that's basically an online checking account, and they offer no fees whatsoever. That's kind of like their tagline. And Digit kind of acts as like a savings account to that checking account.
That's pretty wild. And what about your standard banking? Do you still have a relationship with a bank, Tyler?
Over and what it can take from you. Yeah.
So, do you have both? Do you have a real an old school bank in your life as well, or not?
I do actually. I have a credit union that's actually in Alabama, and I'm in Nashville. So mm-hmm. I do online banking, check depositing with that, and with Simple, I'm able to hook into all of my external accounts, transfer money back and forth. I actually pay my mortgage with my credit union because I use paper checks. Although Simple can send a check from their location to whoever you need.
Tyler, I appreciate your call. Zachary Carabell, what does Zach's story tell you? Is this a revolution, or he's going to sort of play around on the margins with the digital stuff and still be anchored in an old school bank?
Look, like anything else, revolutions are rare and evolutions are common. Mm-hmm. So it is much more likely that you're going to have a juxtaposition of these new technologies, new apps, and new ways of doing things that sit side by side, either simpatico or uneasily, with traditional banking institutions. I mean, take, you played that clip from Betterment, right? And this is a space I know somewhat well. Mm-hmm. The amount of money in these what are now called robo-advisors, you know, do your programs that do your asset allocation and your savings and your investments. There may be $20-plus billion in these versus more than a trillion in the traditional wealth management space, some of which is banks and some of which is independent. It's going to be a long time, if ever, before that ratio gets even close to 50-50. So when I'm talking about the disruption of an industry, disruption does not mean that this old industry is just going to crumble before our eyes, right? I mean, it's possible, but it's unlikely. I don't think you're going to get a you know, what happened with the music industry, which really did come apart pretty quickly because of the disruption of MP3 and Napster and then music sharing. I don't think you're going to get that in the financial world. It's a lumbering beast with too much money. But you will have a lot of the stories that we just heard, which is people kind of, whether it's core and satellite or on the margins, using these kind of cool apps. I mean, Digit is, I've heard about before, it's basically the idea of, you know, we always used to say, if you just save those extra pennies, and not just in a jar, look what you'd have at the end of the year. Well, now you can do it digitally, and it kind of does it for you. And then suddenly, boom, you have a few hundred dollars you didn't expect you would have. Those things can be powerful.
I mean, but it does seem as though it could bring results that will get people's attention pretty soon. Fewer bank branches out there if they're not making money, if millennials aren't setting foot in them. People talking about the ATM going the way of the phone booth, that it just won't be necessary, that the ATM will seem like an outmoded thing, and all kinds of options here. Doug in Salem, Massachusetts. Doug, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out that I do see the appeal of a lot of this technology, and especially when I recall back when I was in my 20s, it took me a long time to even have more than a few hundred dollars extra in my checking account beyond what I was paying for week to week. So certainly there was not a lot of need for me. I would not have had the need to have a sort of big sophisticated system that also had a lot of fees and whatnot. But the thing I just wanted to point out was that if you look at some of the countries right now, China most in particular, that their banking system is probably a lot closer to what our system used to be like. It's much more related to personal connections, and it's very localized. And a lot of our regulations are there for some pretty good reasons. The first off was the Great Depression, where suddenly everybody's savings were wiped out in a heartbeat. And, you know, if you're putting all your money into online banks, are they backed by the federal government? I mean, do you have $100,000 insurance that's going to back what you have in there? And secondly, I think this distributed system where, again, I totally can see the appeal. I've backed a number of projects on Kickstarter and sort of distributed loan systems like that. So I absolutely support that idea, at least to a certain point, but I also can see that if a lot of this moves into that area, you know, where's the regulation to say that there's not going to be a lot of discrimination when it's online? And lastly, this is clearly going to skew toward the well-educated and tech-savvy populace, and I think it will could end up potentially leaving out a pretty large area of the population who really maybe is not able to navigate some of these
Doug, I'm so glad you raised all that. We're going to turn and look at the unbanked and underbanked that you referenced right there in just a second here. Zachary, what about those? Safety, security?
So those are always, I mean, that is such a great set of issues that, of course, are going to arise. And you're totally right. The caller's totally right that all the regulations we have arose because something happened. People lost their money. They were suckered into investments that were poor choices, and they lost their money. On and on and on. And all that has to be worked out. What's interesting is part of what's going on right now has actually been facilitated by legislation, by the Jobs Act of 2012, which allows for things like Kickstarter and other kinds of what are called crowdfunding in a much simpler way, meaning it allows people who have less money to use up to $2,000 or 5% of their income for very risky ventures, for the kind of Kickstarter, you know, for somebody who has a hope and a dream. It kind of democratizes what's now very
elite. But Kickstarter's been for no return, right? And soon the SEC...
Well, Kickstarter is for no return, and then there are now groups that are saying, look, we're gonna allow for equity ownership of investments.
You're writing about this
it's
new
moving in that direction.
This new SEC, rules going into effect early next year that will let...
Correct.
I mean, quoting you here, any company or person with an idea can solicit and raise up to $1 million without most of the onerous regulatory and reporting requirements of the past. It doesn't have to come from rich folks.
Right. And it can come from someone doing $2,000. Now, the caller is also correct that that means, you know, this is still an elite phenomenon, or it's people who have some discretionary income. And while I know we're going to talk about the unbanked, I think a lot of these technologies actually allow for much more potential for the traditionally unbanked, and, meaning it doesn't create a digital divide. It actually crosses that digital divide much
more. What about risk? Who's going to be looking out for snake oil salesmen?
So I think there's a really interesting issue, and this is, I guess, plays to one's different conception of the role of government. You know, to what degree do you want government to try to protect you from your bad choices versus do you want to have the freedom to make those bad choices? And I think that is, you know, it's something we talk about in multiple areas of society, whether it's guns or drugs and money to some degree as well, and gambling, right? People are allowed to go and lose all their money gambling. Mm-hmm. It's not wise, and we don't recommend it, but it's not illegal. And I think in some sense, it's not – one should never pretend that these are not highly speculative investments if you're going to crowdfund a startup. And that's partly why there's a limit on what individuals can contribute in these new regulations, but there's not an absolute prohibition against it, meaning the idea of this app world is you should be free to make bad choices, whether that's buying – you know, a huge amount of artisanal stuff on Etsy that you don't need, or whether it's deciding that some guy has a great idea for an app that's going to mow the lawn and you want to give him $2,000, it doesn't obviate the risk. It just means it is a very much of a buyer beware or a lender beware or an investor beware world.
And you'll suddenly be able to think about all kinds of investment opportunities. Here's a little promo from an outfit called Seed Invest. It's part of this new wave of crowdfunding, offers equity investments to those who put their money down. And here's a promotional video for one of the startups looking for investors on Seed Invest. This is Evelo. It's an electric bike company. So listen and weigh whether you're prepared to put your $1,000 or $2,000 down here.
We truly believe that electric bikes are the future of personal transportation, and we want to make them mainstream in North America. To accomplish these goals faster and make Evelo a household brand, we want to collaborate with a small group of investors that believe in the potential of electric bikes and want to be a part of this rapid growth.
Now, you too can be an angel investor or something like it. Maybe that's where you'll get your interest rate on that deposit. But it's not like putting it in the old vault. Kathy in Charleston, South Carolina. Kathy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Companies like Uber and Airbnb, they basically take an industry that has rules and regulations, in some cases labor unions, taxes that they have to pay, and then they basically create a company that doesn't have to follow the same rules that the other companies in that similar industry have to follow.
Yeah.
And I guess it seems as if the taxes are there for a reason, and especially the regulations are there for a reason. And it's one thing if it's a taxi, you know, service, but it's a whole different thing if it's affecting the economy and if it's affecting the finance system.
Kathy, I love your call and I appreciate it. Thank you very much for that. I mean, Zachary, and right along Kathy's line, Jeff says online here, banks start to lose their business. FDIC depositors are imperiled. Right. I mean, what if? Yeah, we've seen what Uber did to the rest of the system that people may count on.
So there's a term in kind of economics and government called regulatory capture. And part of it is, and I may be using it inappropriately here, but the idea is there's regulation that was that came out of a moment in time to protect people or to protect the system. There's also a point at which regulation is used by dominant players in an industry to prevent competition, to prevent new entrants from coming in. And I think we always need to be careful of, is Regulation X protecting us from, you know, loan sharks and fraud, or is Regulation X preventing positive dynamic change? And that's a big issue around Uber, right? Uber argues, obviously it argues, that it's just old, you know, taxi and limousine commissions embedded with local governments that are preventing cheaper, easier rides, and therefore that those regulations are not helping consumers. They're helping taxi and limousine
commissions. But Kathy's looking with a more gimlet eye at banking here and saying, okay, it's one thing if it's about a car ride somewhere or even about a room for the night, but this is about her life savings potentially.
Right. And this is where, back to the discussion earlier, you know, some of this is always going to be buyer beware. So what the current regulatory framework, I think this is interesting because, you know, there's a belief that Washington can't do any regulation, right? What the Jobs Act does is said, we're going to allow for this kind of highly speculative, risky fundraising, but we're going to cap the amount of risk or exposure any individual can have. So if you, you know, if you're someone with a middle class income, you can put up to $2,000 in one of these. You can't put up to $20,000. Mm-hmm. The idea being, what's a reasonable amount of risk and loss? We don't have that in gambling regulation. That would be really interesting, right? If Vegas and everybody else, all the casinos, you could go in, but you could only lose up to X, X being what you could really afford, quote unquote, to lose. So it's not like we regulate risk throughout every industry, right? You can go into a mall and spend way too much money and max out your credit cards. There's no law against that. So I think we have to think about this as, we do allow people to risk their incomes and their money in ways they probably shouldn't. We do that a lot less when it comes to actual investments, and we probably could afford to do it a little bit more for our collective good, even while enhancing a little bit our collective risk.
Kathy, thanks for your call. Jess in Dayton, Ohio. Jess, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. I was just calling because I agree quite a bit with the last two callers. I think that this is like, it sounds great. It sounds like a great idea. And I think that providing competition for the banks is a good thing because I think they've had very little competition for a while. But like the two previous callers, I can definitely see a lot of risk. I mean, I'm thinking back to like the panic in 1837 where you had just, you know, not a lot of regulations on what, on people who could create banks. So you just had these wealthy individuals down in the South coming together and having a bunch of money and then like lending it out to themselves and lending it out to their friends and then, you know, bundling up those like loans into big trusts and selling them to companies overseas. And it just, it created all this fake currency kind of very similar to what happened in 2008. And to me, this just kind of screams of that. I know I like the regulations that he talked about. You know, when I first called in, he hadn't mentioned the $2,000 limit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still just, does kind of stink of it to me. And I was wondering what the your guest thought about
it. It's great.
That.
First of all, Tom, you got to love a show where someone calls in and references the Panic of 1836.
Oh, we do love that show. That's us, baby.
That is great as a as a contemporary reflection on whether or not the Uberization in 2015 is a good thing. And isn't the caller's entirely right to reference those moments in time because that is, in fact, where our regulatory framework comes from. And
so,
he's entirely right. You have
so
these
does Janet
banks.
Yellen have a seat at this table, this new table you're talking about, or not, to watch flows and all the rest?
Yeah, I mean, in the sense, I mean, the Fed is one of the major banking regulators, along with 12 other government agencies, or however many number there are. Look, this is not a debate we're going to answer right now, and I totally respect. I mean, I am not saying we should just kind of ditch regulations and have a renewal of a Wild West world. But it is also true that our current system does not allow for a lot of capital to be put in motion in a way that a lot of people want to put their capital in motion. And that can be a very constructive thing societally. And having that movement of money, which always entails some risk, it's a matter of finding the right balance between risk and putting money in motion for new ideas, new possibilities, and making our own lives easier and less frictionful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how more technology is about to change banking pretty big time. Saving, borrowing, lending, investing, maybe everything. It's being called by my guest, Zachary Karabell, the Uberization of banking, or even the Uberization of money itself. He's with InvestNet, a publicly traded financial services firm. His essay in the Wall Street Journal, The Uberization of Money. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us today. What do you think? What's the deepest you've gone into this brave new world? And what about the people banking is already leaving out, leaving behind? Are you among those, the unbanked, the underbanked, not really being served well now or at all? Will the Uberization of money work for everybody or for the already privileged? Zachary Karabell, please stand by in New York. Joining us now from Athens, Georgia, is Mirza Baradaran. She is professor of law at the University of Georgia School of Law. Been looking at the nearly 30% of U.S. households that, according to the FDIC, are left out or underserved by our current banking system. The unbanked, nearly 9.6 million households, don't have a bank account. And the underbanked, nearly 25 million households, have a bank account but maybe can't get a credit card or even a small loan. She writes about all of it in her new book, How the Other Half Banks, Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. Mirza Baradaran, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Why do we have such a large number of people who are unbanked or underbanked?
Well, it's simple. The banks have just lost interest in serving that population. And I want to address a little bit of the banking system, as your earlier caller, Zachary, or earlier guest, Zachary, mm-hmm. was talking mm-hmm. about. I want to emphasize that it's the banks do several different things. One is that they do transaction accounts. And so this is what Zachary's saying, that could be easily made faster and more accessible through technology. And this is
like
where
what? What do you mean by transaction
account? You know, you need to send money from X, you know, point A to point B,
yeah.
or you want to take your paycheck and turn it into a, you know, money to pay your bills,
mm-hmm.
things like that. These
mm-hmm.
nodes of finance that we all use. And, you know, typically in the past, banks have had a monopoly on these routes through the Federal Reserve
yep.
clearinghouse system, where you had to, you know, meet at a Federal Reserve in some city and exchange checks. Now, that is no longer the case. There's no reason banks need to be involved here. But I want to emphasize that that is a very small portion of what banks do. And this is, I think, what Zachary, has made clear in the Uberization aspect, where these new quote-unquote innovators or quote-unquote disruptors can really have an impact here and help us, you know, through PayPal or Venmo or whatever it is. But there's a whole nother aspect of banking, which is a much larger and more important aspect, and that's credit allocation, deposit taking, loan making.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where your callers before are expressing discomfort. Look, we have a banking system that doesn't work as an intermediary the way people typically think of it. It is not as though banks take those deposits, just hold on to those deposits, some of them in the back, and then they lend out the rest of them. If we had had that banking system, our economy would have screeched to a halt
mm-hmm.
somewhere in the 1940s or 50s. Bank loans don't come from deposits. Bank loans come from federal government investment in banks through Federal Reserve reserve accounts, through, you know, trillions of dollars of discount window loans, reserve requirements. It's very complex monetary policy that cannot be quote unquote Uberized because it is not a market in the way we typically think of that. So I understand this idea that peer-to-peer lending, which is what the Jobs Act covers, not banks, by the way. The Jobs Act is specifically not a banking regulatory act of legislation. So that can have some, you know, significant, you know, advantages for small businesses, artists, even lower income folks who are entrepreneurial in nature, et cetera. What I try to cover in the book is a larger aspect of banking. And this is, you know, we've got such a huge portion of the population that doesn't have access to these federal government channels of credit savings. And this is where your earlier caller was talking about FDIC insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fine. You know, Zachary talked about gambling. We don't consider depositing our money in a bank gambling. And we're not comfortable with letting those banks fail because they have our hard-earned money. And that's why we have such a regulatory, you know, overlay. And is it too much? Perhaps. But was there ever a Wild West where banks were unregulated? No. That's a myth that a lot of people come back to where, we have all this new regulation now and that's made things harder. We have never not had. In fact, we are at the lowest regulatory, you know, moment in our nation's history, in any nation of the world. world, it used to be that banks were so regulated that they could only have one branch in one city and they couldn't expand or move money around. And we are very much away from that now.
But it's a disturbing picture you paint there where the government is floating so much of this activity and still a big part of the population doesn't have access to that because the banks don't want to do business with them. There's not enough profit, perhaps, in their interactions, so they're left out there with payday lenders and these load them up debit cards and all the rest. Why have these numbers grown so much, Marissa?
Yeah, and that's exactly why my subtitle is a threat to democracy, because I don't see it as an economic problem. I don't see it as something that is disruptible, to use the words of the market. This is a social political problem. It is, the banks are floated by federal government money. We saw this in the bailout. We've seen it, from the beginning of the bank government relationship, dating back to the signing of our Constitution. So, your audience is clearly a well educated one, so they can go back far with me into these, points in our nation's history where the banks and the government are so clearly intertwined, and we are much more so now than before, especially since all of those trillions of dollars of bailout funds. And I think it is a threat to democracy in our political system that these banks are no longer serving the low income. Since 2003, I believe, or six, I can't remember the date, but about 93% of bank closings have been in low income areas. And it's because of the conglomeration and the high competition among banks. We don't have those regulations anymore that force banks to stay in one area. So banks conglomerate. I use a reference in the book of, we have this myth of George Bailey's bank being, this, mm-hmm. the way that we're going to bank communities. But George Bailey's bank got swallowed up by Potter's Bank, sometime in the 80s, and then Potter's Bank got eaten up by Bank of America in the last decade. And so Bank of America.
But people with almost no money are paying the most for these kind of ramshackle quasi-banking services. I mean, it seems backwards. They're paying more than people with money have to do very, very simple, low-dollar transactions.
That's right. That's right. The less money you have, the more you use it, to turn your money into serviceable electronic currency. And that's the other point I think that's worth mentioning, is that a lot of us already operate in this digitized world. You and I, who have bank accounts, we are able to cash our checks and get it through the bank and pay people through this digital currency. A lot of the poor operate in cash still. And so if we're getting rid of ATMs and if we're getting rid of brick and mortar banks, the people that suffer most are the poor, who get paid in cash, who have to stand in line to pay their bills in cash because they don't have, they don't have the 10% of their income that they use to spend on financial services. They don't want to waste that money. And so they end up operating outside these realms of, technology that most of us who have bank accounts have benefits of.
Or even if they're kind of in the technology, it's the most rough and ready end of it. Describe what happened with this the Rush card. This Russell Simmons, the hip-hop guy, founded this. And many low-income Americans use this as kind of a debit card or preloaded card where your paycheck goes under. You don't actually have a bank account, a proper old school bank account. How do these cards work, and what happened with Rush card?
Yeah, I mean, there's a variety of these cards. And some of them are better than others. And some of them, are, quite frankly, the celebrity ones are some of the worst ones. But, the Russell Simmons card, you pay something like $5 just to put money on the card. And then you pay $3 or $5 every time you put more money. And then $2 every time you use it. And then, $2 just to check your balance. And then with the Russell Simmons card, they just stopped working for several days. So a lot of people whose essential all of their savings were on these cards just didn't have access to their money. And it caused a huge outrage. And this is the kind of thing where people who have bank accounts that are regulated by the FDIC or the Federal Reserve, or the OCC or whatever, don't have to worry about. And these unregulated financial service providers do end up making mistakes. And this is with other people's money. And this goes back to the sense of, we regulate banks for a reason. And the reason is because they're not playing around with their own money. They're playing around with our money. And so there's this market that banks the unbanked. And those are the least regulated. And I find that to be problematic, not just as a, you know, a matter of morals, but as a matter of democracy.
I want to ask you how all this new technology may or may not help fix that. I'm reading Renee Lothier in the Boston Globe. She was writing about what there was a Kardashian card for a while. $99, $99.95 to open an account, $7.95 a month after that, plus all kinds of per-use fees. It's shut down now. But that's the kind of banking service that low-income Americans have been offered many times. Cynthia in Cosby, Tennessee, you're on with Mirza Baradaran and Zachary Carabell. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello, Tom. I just have a comment. I am so glad you have heard this program because I am one of those people, single, self-employed, modest income but successful business, a credit score over 800,
okay.
And I simply cannot get anybody to refinance my mortgage for me.
Because self-employed.
So I write up everything I can just like all the big guys do.
So, Cynthia, stand by. Zachary, where would you point Cynthia to at least look for some of these new offerings that might help her out in that circumstance?
So it's interesting, and this keys into a little bit what Mirza was just saying. There are also now a series of groups that are trying to address things like the way the algorithms of credit scores don't distinguish between someone like the caller and someone who, you know, has no income and really is a credit risk, because they're big formulas that correlate a bunch of data. They don't really look at anybody individual. And there's some people who broke off from Google a couple of years ago, started something called Zest Finance to say, look, we could do a much better job tailoring credit scores to actual people rather than people's data giving us probabilities and then we just kick people out of the risk pool because their probabilities.
Is that
don't
up and running?
Right,
this is this outfit called Basix, B-A-S-I-X, lending services for near prime folks with, you know, pretty decent credit scores. But is that operating now? Can Cynthia go there and refinance?
I mean, look, I don't know the warp and woof of all these different sites. It's certainly worth looking into. And I think the reality is there are people addressing these things. I probably take a different view than Mirza on I think there are a lot of parts of the world that are very scantily regulated. Kenya, for instance, which really didn't have a centralized banking system, where things like mobile payments and the unbanked developing an entire architecture to transact that isn't banking dependent and is much lower cost, by the way, is
can
also
part of that. Can I talk about Kenya for a second?
Well, before we get to Kenya, I don't want to leave Cynthia hanging there. She wants to refinance.
Yeah.
She's got her own small business. It's not huge money, but a good credit score. Where does she go?
SoFi. You know, you can certainly try SoFi. You can try Lending Club or Lending Tree. And see where that leads you. You know, there's a huge variability in these newer sites in terms of what the rates are.
Cynthia, I wish you luck with that. Let me turn to Kenya, maybe through a caller here. Otavio is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Otavio, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just one quick point to make. I think, you know, one thing that's interesting is there are countries around the world where we can, you know, look and see kind of where the future of online or mobile banking could go for us.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya, I think, being the most interesting example. In Kenya, there's a system called M-Pesa, which about 70 to 80% of the population uses, a largely poor and rural population, and it allows them to save money in M-Pesa and then make payments as well. So, you know, it's basically succeeded in bringing a largely rural and poor population into the banking system, and I think it's kind of shows that similarly, you know, online mobile banking here in the U.S. could kind of do the same thing for an unbanked population.
Otavio, I'm delighted for your call. Is this the model, Mercy, in Kenya?
So I've heard Kenya used a lot, and there's a reason why Kenya is used a lot. It's because it's the only successful mobile banking example out there, and it is not for lack of trying. Every other country that's tried it has failed to do what Kenya has done. And here's what was unique about Kenya. It had one central bank, one mobile provider, Sofitel, and they were able – and then an 80% unbanked population. So what they have done was phenomenal. They linked forces, and again, this was not an unregulated bank. This was the central bank of the country, so a very different model than what we have. They linked forces. They brought mobile payments to everyone, and so they were able to transact. It brought up the incomes of the Kenyan population up to something like 30%. It's hard to measure, but it's been a boon for Kenya, but South Africa tried it and wasn't able to. India, you know, and the U.S., the FDIC, the Federal Reserve have done these studies on mobile banking in the U.S., and it's possible that it would help a lot of us, those who have bank accounts and are already in the digital currency, transact. But I don't see it as a way to bring in folks that aren't already there. We're not Kenya, for better or for worse.
Marissa, cut to the chase here. Are you responding to Zachary's Uberization of money with a big nope? It's not going to happen because the government's not going to swing behind it. And then what about the underbanked? Where do they turn?
Look, I mean, the Uberization, Uber is funny because I don't think we can Uberize everything. And I think technology has, but like I said in the beginning, I think transactions, there's no reason why we need banks as a middleman anymore to do these transaction accounts. But as far as credit and deposit taking, you most certainly need a middleman that is regulated by the government. Money, it doesn't work like any other market entities, and neither does credit. I mean, your earlier caller was asking about her mortgage. Every mortgage in this country, essentially, except for very few of them, are guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and those are government-sponsored entities. They've been nationalized since 2008. We don't have a mortgage market outside of the federal government, and no other country has a Wild West banking system that is unregulated. So I think if we're talking about markets that operate by pure market principles, definitely Uberize them, cut costs, cut regulation. But when we're talking about banks, banks and governments go hand in hand. And I think we should pay very close attention to what goes on. And I think we should be very careful about making sure that the power doesn't get too big, et cetera. But I think to treat them like, you know, Uberizable, it misunderstands the function of banks.
Zach, low ceiling on this?
You know, I think this is another hour conversation. I think everything is ultimately changeable and disruptible. And if the only lesson one gains from the Panic of 1837 through the rest of history is that things do change tectonically, usually unexpectedly, but almost inevitably. And I don't think that the banking system as we currently know it is an inevitable structure of our society.
Dear listeners, watch this space and hang on to your wallet or your smartphone, wherever you've got it stashed. Zachary Karabel at InvestNet, thank you very much for being with us, Zachary. Really interesting today.
Thank you.
And Marissa Baradaran, author of How the Other Half Banks. Marissa, in Athens, Georgia, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.